I'm Ed Stocker and welcome to the big interview on Monocle 24. My guest today is renowned New York-based artist Robert Longo. Born in Brooklyn and raised on Long Island, Longo studied at the University of North Texas, leaving before completing his degree to pursue art, first at Nassau Community College in Garden City and then at Sunny Buffalo. In 1974, he co-founded Hallwalls Contemporary Art Center in an ice packing warehouse in that city, an establishment that quickly made a name for itself. But Longo cemented his career when he moved to New York City and produced a haunting series of drawings called Men in Cities, first exhibited at Metro Pictures in 1981. Also a celebrated sculptor, musician, and filmmaker, Longo is best known for his cinematic charcoal drawings, from shark heads to waves to the American flag, that often have powerful statements to make about politics and society. Thank you so much for joining us in the studio here in New York on quite a cold, blustery autumnal day. I guess my first question is whether you always felt that you wanted to be an artist. Did you have a kind of lightning moment when you knew this was your calling?
No, I'm first generation Italian, so it's like opera culture is somewhat part of my family. My sister was an opera singer. But the idea of being an artist, I mean, I could always draw, and I couldn't read. I was dyslexic, but I could always draw. But being an artist always seemed kind of kinky and not interesting to me. I always imagined those guys with the striped shirts and the berets and always sticking their thumb up and stuff like that. So I never thought about being an artist for sure. But the irony of it is that after failing at everything else in my life, I wanted to be a marine biologist because I love surfing, and then I wanted to do music. I was playing in a band, and after failing a number of things, I realized the only thing I could be really good at was drawing, so I thought maybe I should investigate art. And I didn't quite have the courage to say that I wanted to be an artist, so I thought maybe I'll learn restorations of painting and become an art historian. So I got a scholarship. I went to study in Florence, and when I got there, I was assisting people during the restorations, and I became very critical of what I was watching being done. And then at one point I had this cathartic moment when I thought, there's enough old shit in the world, you know? Maybe it's time for me to make my own stuff. And there was a kind of awakening, for sure. I think it happened when I was in Florence, of all places. I was sitting underneath that copy of David, where he's holding the slingshot. There was a pigeon sitting on this. I was sitting underneath it, trying to pick up some girl in this Palazzo, and this pigeon dumped this huge shit on my head. And
that was your moment,
and I was
a pigeon
about to,
shitting on
and
your
I was,
head.
I was about to tell her I was going to become an artist, and she said to me, oh, that's really good luck.
There you go. So you've been blessed for those reasons.
By pigeon shit. I owe everything to that pigeon. Anyway, so it was like an awakening, and then I had to go about figure out how to do it. That was the next step, and the course to doing it is, if there is God, he's the guy that gives out luck. I think luck is a really important thing, and I think you have to create situations that make luck want to visit you. So that's what I think I did. That's why I'm in the position I'm in. I'm very fortunate, for sure, but I also created a situation where I had a big net to catch luck, for sure. And that was, I think, really important. Because I always think about, I have friends who are artists. There are lots of artists that have missed their opportunities. History goes by and things like that. You know, but it is a lot about luck, for sure. Yeah.
I want to take you back before that, though. You studied at the University of North Texas. Yeah. And you seem like you were a slight anomaly. You seem to be the slightly counterculture jock. Is that an accurate description?
Absolutely. In high school, it started in high school. I graduated from high school in 1970. And I rebelled. I was one of the captains of the football team, and I played middle linebacker, and I loved football. I loved the violence of it. At the same time, I had started smoking pot and listening to lots of music and growing my hair long. And my coach was like completely freaked out by the fact that I wanted to wear 00, which was like, he just didn't get it. You know, I kept saying this infinity, it's infinity, man, it's a different number. But Anyway, what ended up happening is while I was in high school, there was a guy that I knew, I didn't know him very well, who got shot at Kent State. And I've only really recently kind of revisited this, thinking about it, how much the impact this had, that image of him being, he was the guy laying on the ground by the girl screaming over his body, you know, this really famous photograph. And I started organizing student protests in the school. And at the same time, also was making the posters for the protests and drawing the posters. So when I got to Texas at that time, when I was at North Texas, I was trying to do music at that point. And the problem is North Texas was the only school I could actually get into, and the football helped me get into it. But the level of football there was like I'd never seen before. It was like, it was so insane, and everyone wanted to shave their heads. And
you were the guy with the long hair.
Yeah, and I got hurt probably relatively early, and I was also smoking way too much pot and taking way too much acid and things like that. And yeah, so it was like kind of time to like quit and hang, you know. And I ended up flunking out of school, so it was like my in a tailspin at that point for sure.
You didn't end up completing your degree, and not immediately afterwards, but you ended up in Buffalo.
Then I went to night school. I went to night school,
yeah.
And then from there I met this teacher, Leonora Frink, who like kind of helped me find this scholarship to the Restoration Place. And from there, kind of one thing led to another. And then women always had a big part of my life as when I was younger, before I actually really figured out about art. And there was this really cute girl who said, oh, you should go to Buffalo. There's a really great art school there. But she was like a home economics major. Do you remember?
Yeah.
A really weird category. She was going to become a home economics teacher. So I went to Buffalo following her, and they had a really shitty art school, a really kind of conventional art school. But across the street was a really great museum. And in a weird way, being in a really kind of mediocre art school gave you a reason to rebel against it, which a lot of my friends went to Cal Arts, went to a really kind of super art school, the real cutting edge stuff. I met a lot of those people later on, and we had very similar sensibilities, which was kind of interesting. But Buffalo was like really great. Buffalo was like a almost like a Midwest city that was like dying. It had steel mills and things like that. It was really kind of a sad place, you know. And
yeah, which is, I'm interested because of that reputation it has. I mean, I'm interested to know what that art scene was like there, because Buffalo, like you were saying, does have that reputation of being this sort of northern New York State industrial city.
Yeah, it's pretty dead in a lot of ways. It had three things there. It had the Albright Knox Art Gallery, which is an extraordinary museum. It's like, it's a really incredibly important. It has, Clifford Still donated a whole bunch of his paintings there. It had amazing Pollocks. It had a really extraordinary art collection. It was, I think in a weird way, in my mind, it rivaled like the modern for modern art. And there was also this experimental music program there where Morton Feldman was there. There were poets like Robert Creeley was there. And then there was also this amazing film program at the university where Hollis Frampton and Paul Sheritz and these guys, all like structuralist filmmakers, all taught. So that was happening there. But I went to the Buffalo State College, which was a smaller version of it, was what I could get into at that point. And it had a really shitty art department, but it was literally across the street from the Albright Knox. So, I mean, all those things kind of were conducive to it. But the thing is, like, it was a city that was dying, which is where a lot of, like, the punk music came out of, like Cleveland, things like that. It was like this kind of dead city in a weird way, a dead American city. It had this most spectacular train station where all the American GIs during the First and Second World War would come through when they come down the St. Lawrence Freeway, the waterway, and they would come there and then get unloaded and then basically be distributed back into America. So it was like a small version of Grand Central Station, but it was always totally empty. So it was really cool to go and hang out there.
I guess in a way it was a good challenge, perhaps, to be in a city like that. I mean, you managed to set up Hall Walls, which was an institution, an art center that made a name for itself, and you managed to lure talent from places like New York City. How did you do that?
That's really interesting. When I was in Buffalo, I started getting more and more interested in contemporary art, but I was really fortunate to meet this guy named Charlie Clough, who was living in this old ice, what was used to be an ice factory, which is ironic in Buffalo, an ice factory, and that had been converted to artist studios, really shitty, funky studios. But he was like a real artist. He was a little older than I was, and he had tons of magazines and books. And I realized to learn about contemporary art, it could actually be pretty fast. It wasn't like I was learning the history of art. I had to learn like the last 20 years. And through him, I developed this relationship, and I kind of got more and more passionate about what I was doing. And this hallway that existed between my space and his space, Charlie knew, he told me about these, there were these alternative spaces that were developing in the United States. And there was one in Cleveland, there was one in Toronto, where they basically got some money from the government, and they created these alternative spaces rather than being New York City. And so we started to start our own space here called Hall Walls. And then someone said to us, why don't you try to get money from the government? So we said, really? And so we wrote some grants and we got some money, and slowly it started to pay for itself. And at that time, I just met Cindy Sherman, and we were living together around the corner, and I said, let's move. There's a space in the building. Let's move there. So we all moved in together, and it was like a fairy tale. We looked through the art magazines and said, so who do you like? Who do you like? Let's go to New York City, take the bus to New York City, knock on the doors, say, hey, we're these artists. We have a little money. We can get you a lecture at the university. We can even do a little installation. Want to come to Buffalo?
And they came.
Yeah, and they really came. It was like really quite, it was like, what's that thing, what's that movie where the Field of Dreams, like, if you build it, they will come, you know, or something like that.
Are you referencing Kevin Costner with me?
I'm sorry. I kind of like that movie. I'm a sucker for sports movies. Sports is like always really important. But the thing is, it was really interesting that they really came. And what was interesting, they came to Buffalo, and they stayed with us in this big loft that we had. And some of them actually got snowed in, like Richard Serra got snowed in. He had to stay like 3 or 4 days. I was so aggressively eager to learn stuff. It was like I would attack them with like questions and information. It was like almost like graduate school. And I got to meet all these people that were my heroes in a very isolated situation, which was really great.
But then you eventually made that decision to move to New York City, slightly because of an exhibition you were invited to be part of at Artist Space, no?
There was two things how I ended up in New York, which was ironic. It's like the idea of going to New York was always there. But when
you're from here.
But yeah, but I mean, when you grow up on Long Island like I did, you just run away. I didn't grow up in the city. You know, I was born in Brooklyn, but I never thought about going back. I knew I would have to go to New York, but when? So having this opportunity to do this pictures exhibition was a reason to go. At the same time, Cindy had just gotten a grant. So we had money. So we had the money, had the reason. I had the Volkswagen van from being a hippie, and a friend of mine was going away for 6 months and I could sublet his loft. So it was like all the pieces kind of fell into place that led us there.
I mean, it was in New York not long after you arrived that you had perhaps your series of work that has kind of cemented your career, Men in Cities. What inspired you to do that? What gave you the idea to present this to the public?
There's a bunch of things that kind of form this kind of vortex, how they all come together. One of them has to do with during the picture show. The last piece that I made for the picture show was based upon an image from a still from a movie, American Soldier, of a man being shot. And it just really resonated in me, and I made this cast aluminum relief where I kind of painted it. But it was this one piece in the show that got the most attention, which was really interesting. And I realized that it had some profound connection to me because it had the violence, it had the impact, it had the media. As a child, I also played this ridiculous game called Who Could Fall Dead the Best. Like, one guy would pretend to have a gun, and he had to have at least three people. So you would compete who would fall dead the best. Then you would be the guy that got to shoot. And we got quite elaborate, because dying in movies had, in the 70s, had changed. Like, the 60s and 70s, Sam Peckinpah came along. So people in the movies died really quite dramatically, as opposed to, like, when James Cagney would die, he would just kind of fall over. You know, in Peckinpah's movies, people would explode. So at the same time, what happened was there was this amazing band called The Contortions. And I realized that the punk scene was really exploding, and I started playing bands and stuff like that. And there's this spasmatic, jerky movements that would happen with punk stuff that really, like almost like psychotic impulses, that somehow kind of fused with this, like this image of like the dance of death, and they kind of fused together. Like, if you go to punk scenes, you would see people dancing. They weren't very graceful. They really kind of, the more spazzy they were, the cooler it was. So I kind of fused those two things together. And the other thing is, I also realized what was really quite important. I remember reading an interview by Yannis Kounellis, who was an artist who I really loved. He thought it was really important that you work towards affection. And that is that you may do lots of different works, but if there's one work that gets the most attention, you should follow that. You should follow that affection. So that was that one relief called The American Soldier got so much attention, it made me say, maybe I should drop making movies, drop the performance, drop the bands. Maybe I should really focus on this. But I had no money, and the only thing I could do at that point was draw. So I realized I couldn't get images from the media fast enough, so I realized maybe I should take my own pictures. So I started dragging my friends up to the roof.
And you threw things at them.
Yeah, yeah. One time one guy almost fell off the roof, which was pretty fucking scary.
Taking evasive action from your pummeling.
Yeah, so and at that point, just the work just exploded.
Just so listeners understand, these are kind of figures of well-dressed men in kind of contorted shapes.
But the thing is, the irony is that they weren't well-dressed. They were the way we were dressing at the time. They were clothes that we bought, like at the used clothes. We wore skinny ties, skinny lapels, you know, black boots, sometimes like old Beetle boots. It wasn't like we were yuppies. That's where it kind of gets confused. It was basically the attire.
Like punk chic.
Yeah. There was a real difference between New York City was divided. The new wave punk scene was clearly divided. If you use Broadway as the dividing line, the East Side was more the punk side. That was where, like, where CBGB's was. That's where the East Village kind of developed. The West Side was more like where the artists were and where the kind of art music was happening, like Glenn Bronk or Reese Chatham, things like that. And the style was much more severe. It's much more austere in the way we looked. It wasn't like pushpins and pink and green and
sure.
and leather. It was more like these kind of like suits and almost like teddy boys sometimes. It was a bit more severe. But it was a very different dividing line. And yeah, I think that was really important.
But and I mean, these get translated through charcoal and graphite into these almost otherworldly images nonetheless. Do you think you were aiming for some of the interpretations that are now attributed to it? People talk of kind of this dystopian society, a reflection of capitalism. There are all sorts of theories out there. I want to hear it from the horse's mouth.
Yeah, it kind of what's weird is like when there's two things. As an artist, you try to believe that you're making work that exists on multiple levels of meaning. So it resonates. You know, you're aware that a way that people look at art differently than they do when they walk down the street. It's a focus kind of looking. But at the same time, as an artist, you're blind. You have no idea how someone sees your work. I can't tell how you see what I do. So I'm blind in that sense. It's a kind of ironic thing. But the thing was, there was something that was clearly going on. It was media images, violence, the evoking a little bit of like, my studio was down by the Wall Street stock market. So the suits and ties were somewhat, I mean, there was with the way we were dressing, but it was evoking a little bit of those people, the yuppies and stuff like that. So the same time, how people read it, I was very surprised and happy. And it gave me the opportunity to keep doing work. But the irony, what happened is the work entered so quickly into the psyche of the culture that I pretty quickly realized I had to stop doing it. It was like, it became accepted too quickly. I ran away from it. I ran away from it for years. And the irony is, like, I guess maybe 4 or 5 years ago, there was a show at the Metropolitan Museum called Pictures Generation. And hanging in the lobby were three of the Men in City drawings. They're 8 feet tall. They're huge. Drawings are 30 years old. And my son, at the time, like 15, his girlfriend was there at the opening. And she asked me if I got the idea for these images from the iPod ads. And I was about to give her this whole lecture. No, these drawings are 30 years old. iPads rip me off, blah, 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 blah. And I thought, well, this is what happens if you're successful enough as an artist. Your images enter into the culture and you lose authorship.
You think they copied it?
Of course. I mean, it's like I see it all over the place. I mean, at first I got outraged by it, but then I realized this is a compliment. My language has kind of become part of the culture, which is kind of interesting.
Does it annoy you or frustrate you? Maybe those aren't the right words, but talking about something that is or was produced 30 odd years ago, do you mind still talking about
that? You know, I ran away from it for years. I don't know how it happened, but the original photographs of the drawings I'd never done anything with. And Cindy one time said to me, you know, you should do a book of these pictures. And I realized, okay, I'm old enough now. It's been enough time. I'll reclaim this work. I'll acknowledge that they're mine. And it's been an interesting experience. The other thing is you realize as an artist, a lot of artists are remembered by one thing. You know, Koons will be remembered for like the blow up shiny bunny rabbit. Cindy will be remembered for like her movie stills. There are these archetypal images. So what my part in history right now is are those images for sure. I mean, I would be a fool to not say they're mine. So they're fucking mine.
Yes, reclaim them. Yeah. Let's talk about kind of your body of work. You seem to be, and I want to hear how you feel about that. You seem to be quite political. You've tackled male oppression. You've tackled the European refugee crisis, arguably capitalism. Is that front and center to your work?
I'm not a political person by nature. I just like am compelled. I mean, I get angry and rage. Basically, you look at the world we live in right now with this fucking idiot Trump, really. I mean, it's just like perfect example of something. I saw this image in a newspaper. It was the riot cops in Ferguson.
I was going to talk to you about that. Yeah.
And when I saw this image in a newspaper, I first saw it when I just thought it was like the Ukraine, or this was maybe like, you know, someplace in Iraq. And then off in the distance, I saw McDonald's and I saw the Exxon sign. I went, this is fucking the United States. So at that point, it was like making work is a way of a cathartic experience of actually owning it and taking it in on a, almost a molecular level. You process it by drawing it. It's going into you in that sense. But I think the thing is, I bought the rights from the photograph from somebody else, and then I got a couple of pictures and composited it and made this huge line of cops. I wanted to show it at the art fair in Miami. Some people were saying, oh, I don't think it's the right time to show it. I said, fuck, you have to show it. And the day that I showed it in Miami, the day that the Miami art fair opened, that was the same day that the cops got proven innocent from strangling that guy on the street in New York. So it was like
Eric Gardner.
Yeah. So I got like a, I had almost like a press agent for me working for me. I mean, I can always count on the world to provide fucked up pictures of me to work.
So this was the unrest in Ferguson, Missouri back in 2014, which has been called the sort of image of the year or art piece of the year by some media outlets. Were you surprised at all by the reaction that piece of work produced?
You know, I didn't know what to expect. I was already thinking ahead, like I wanted to do the protesters. Every time I started to work at images of the protesters with their hands up, it wasn't qualified to give them enough respect for somehow. It was really, it looked like they were doing the Macarena or something. It just didn't have it. And then there was this image, a football player being introduced during a game with his hands up, and this blew my mind. And then I saw more photographs. Actually, this is in my show that's coming up in May, of five football players. If you know anything about American football, the receiving corps on the football teams.
I don't.
Well, the receivers on the football team, the guys that catch the passes, they're the real nuts on the team. The receiving corps, these five guys all came out when they're being introduced with their hands up. And it was like, do you know the John Carlos, Tommy Brown image of the guys with the black gloves on at the Olympics?
Yeah.
It's that kind of image. They came out in their football equipment, being introduced in a spotlight in a stadium, primarily white people cheering them with their hands up. And I started realizing, here are these guys with their hands up, wearing equipment that's not a whole lot different than what the cops were wearing, playing a game that's basically a violent, oppressive game, and that the kid that was shot in Ferguson, Michael Brown, was the size of a football player. He was like 6'4", 300 pounds. And here they are cheering these black men. The irony about sports in America is, I find, really quite profound, because America is different than any other country in the world. It is a sports team. It's a country that's not necessarily based on a tribe, it's not based on a race or a nationality or even supposedly a religion. It's all these people working together for one goal. But the problem is, what's the goal of a sports team? To win. And that's what really makes America fucking dangerous. There's a really great book by Robert Kagan called Dangerous Nation. The United States, since its inception, was a fucking nightmare for the rest of the world because we were a sports team. Our main goal was to win.
You mentioned Trump just now, just a few days before the election. How frightened are you about the way this country is going, irrespective of who wins, but perhaps how polarized the nation seems to be becoming?
America is a country of idiots. I mean, you can't ignore it. 350 million people here, there have to be a lot of stupid people. It's just, you know, the kind of freedom that we have in America allows stupidity to blossom. You know, if you bring in religion into it, Who's that guy, Turkerville, that came, a French guy who came here years ago, like, you know, in the 1800s to write about America? He wasn't that far off. It's a country that talks about individuality, but is highly conformist. It talks about religion, but, you know, the freedom of religion, but everyone thinks this is a Christian country. America is in a really fucked position, but at the same time, sometimes I think 3/4 of the world would move here if they had the chance. You want to believe that it's hopeful, but at the same time, what was really interesting is going to Russia and seeing the world there and seeing Moscow, how Moscow was a bubble, made me realize how much I live in a bubble in New York. I mean, Trump has made me really aware of the amount of stupid people in the United States, which is frightening. And Brexit is a perfect fucking example.
And grievances, though. It's not just, you know, there's a lot of people who have grievances that perhaps aren't being addressed.
Yeah, but I'm very confused about their grievances and where it's based in.
Do you find that some of these difficulties that perhaps the US is living through at the moment give you inspiration? Or perhaps inspiration is the wrong word, but you've always been someone who uses popular culture, who draws on TV. Do you find that this kind of mediatic and kind of strange election process is also giving you inspirational material for future work?
Totally. It's like, it's freaking me out totally, because like Brexit is a perfect example. People in England actually really think they would come out of the union. I mean, that surprise. I think Trump is such a phenomenon. I love, the other thing is I love watching him. I hope he gets his own television station. I think he's amazing. But the thing is, he's defied all the odds. And I think what will happen in the United States, what I'm terrified, is that a lot of liberal conservatives, whatever they are, I mean, liberal Democrats, will think that Hillary Clinton is going to win by such a great margin, they won't go vote, and Trump will win. I mean, there is one thing about Trump winning, is there is this idea that it is a democracy. So he can't be a complete dictator like Putin is. So there is some, but I mean, I dislike his ideas about things. I think this idea is just this disenfranchised aspect of these Americans that he represent. I think this distortion that they have is quite frightening. I mean, I don't see that, what they see, that's a problem.
Now, your career, you know, has spanned over 3 decades. I mean, what keeps you going? What makes you get up in the morning and say, yes, I want to draw, I want to produce a body of work? Do you never think, oh, God, I'm a bit tired of this?
You know, what's interesting is I always viewed sleeping late in the morning as these little suicides. It's like not wanting to face the world. And I distinctly remember not wanting to get out of bed. But now my life is like, I go to bed at night and I can't wait to wake up in the morning, because I have this opportunity that's been given me and to be able to make my work. I mean, being an artist is a privilege. And if you have an opportunity to be successful, you have to figure out a way how to take that opportunity and invest it in the privilege of being an artist. And I mean, I'm out of control in the sense of I can do what I want to do, but I'm much more judicious in my choices. That's the difference between me and me and like 25 years ago. And the ebb and flow of the career makes it so that I'm much more of a wiser person, that I can help younger artists, tell them, you know, be careful of this, be careful of that, you know. I think the younger artists that work for me, I think I don't teach in universities, but I teach in my studio. I don't teach them how to make art, but I teach them how to be artists, which nobody ever taught me how. And that was always maybe a bit of a problem for sure.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Robert Longer.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Ed Stocker, in conversation with Robert Longo. The Big Interview is produced by Guy Lutz and Bill Luty and edited by Claire Crofton. Until next time, all that's left to say is goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.